And accompanied by Will, I entered my master's chamber. It being dark, I could not give a death blow. The hatchet glanced from his head. He sprang from the bed and called his wife. It was his last word. Will laid him dead with a blow of his axe, and Mrs. Travis shared the same fate as she lay in bed. The murder of this family, five in number, was the work of a moment. Not one of them awoke. There was a little infant sleeping in the cradle that was forgotten until we had left the house and gone some distance, when Henry and Will returned and killed it.
The story of Nat Turner's revolt is a maze of mysteries and contradictions, but one thing is certain. During the course of 48 hours in August 1831, a bright, charismatic 30-year-old Virginia slave instigated a rampage of killing that led to the deaths of 55 white men, women, and children, and eventually to the deaths of many innocent blacks. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. Nat Turner said that he had no cause to complain of the treatment his master had given him, so why did he have Travis and his family killed? What did Turner hope to accomplish with his revolt? And what was the result of it? Our guest is Anthony Kay, professor of history and religious studies at the Pennsylvania State University. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
A large, dark, grim, strange, mysterious topic, Nat Turner's revolt. I think we'd better set the stage and go to Virginia in 1831.
This part of Virginia is actually part of the Cotton Belt, and so we tend to think about the South as a kind of cotton kingdom, and most of the South is that. But this is the only part of Virginia where they actually grew cotton. And so it's an area that is having a lot of the economic problems that the rest of Virginia has. They're having problems with soil exhaustion. It's a period of low crop prices. It will become a period of economic depression shortly. But it's also an area that has relatively large plantations. If you go a couple of counties to the north, it's a much different area of smaller farms. And so this is an area that's under a number of different kinds of stress. The economic stress that I've just mentioned, the problems of soil depletion. It's also an area where slaves are being sold out of Upper South into the Deep South in this huge sort of second middle passage. And so Southampton County, where Turner lives, is kind of unusual in the sense that it's a place where production is growing, cotton production is growing, but it also is losing population to the slave trade. So it's kind of on the border of a lot of different kinds of economies and political geographies, as it were.
Is there a way of comparing the treatment of slaves in this part of Virginia with any other place in the South?
It's probably not unusual. It's a place where most slaves, in a way, the United States is somewhat unusual in slavery in other parts of the Americas, in the sense that it's a place where you have a resident planter class. People actually live with their slaves. If you think about parts of the Caribbean, most slave owners actually don't live there. In 1831, slavery is actually kind of breaking down in the British Caribbean. So in the same year, there is what's called the Baptist War, which is an immense slave revolt in Jamaica, which is also very much inspired by Christian slaves. And that's an immense slave rebellion, which takes over almost a third of the entire island. It's a plantation region. It is a place where slaves might go to church with their owners. So it's a place where there's a certain kind of intimacy between slaves and owners, and that kind of intimacy breeds a certain kind of all kinds of feelings, some of them real strife and hostility, and also certain kinds of intimacies and identifications that would actually surprise us.
And yet at the same time, we find some of these laws, such as this one passed by the Virginia legislature April 7, 1831. And this applies also to free Negroes remaining contrary to law were to be sold into slavery. And all meetings of free Negroes or mulattoes at any schoolhouse, church, meeting house, or other place for teaching them reading or writing, either in the day or night, under whatsoever pretext, shall be deemed and considered as an unlawful assembly, punishable by not more than 20 lashes for the Negroes and a fine of $50 for the whites present, whom the court might also send to jail for 2 months. It also provided that any white person for pay assembled with slaves in order to instruct them in reading and writing was to be fined not more than $100 and not less than $10. And that act took effect June 1, 1831.
This is an area that has relatively large free black populations for the United States. So there is, in the era of the Revolution, you have the creation of a large free black population. It has to do with people who leave their owners during the American Revolution. It has to do with slaveholders who are moved by the scruples of the First Great Awakening. It has to do with people who are moved by the scruples of the principles of the American Revolution. And there are a lot of slaves who are emancipated by their owners in the era of the Revolution. And so what comes out of the Revolution is the beginning of this large free black population. But the free black population is a real problem for slavery because they are constantly suspect of, on the one hand, they're not integrated into free society, and so they are kept somewhat separate as a, I wouldn't say a pariah class, but something close to that. And on the other hand, they're not slaves. And so there's a lot of concern among white people, and particularly slaveholders, that free people will become a source of disorder among slaves. And so that is the kind of legislation that you get to control black people, and in particular to prevent them from, in this case, learning how to read. The other part of that legislation that's interesting, and you see this in all this kind of legislation, is it's an attempt to constrain the liberties of free black people. And it also involves disciplining white people. So the law says that it fines white people who are teaching black people how to read. And so this is the nature of slave law itself. One of the kind of distinctions that we make as historians is between a society that has slaves in it and a slave society. And a slave society is a place where the main labor system is based on slavery and also where the free population is brought into the business of enforcing the master-slave relation. And that law is a perfect example of that, even though it involves the free black population. There's a very famous book about free black people, and basically it argues that the book is called Slaves Without Masters. You get the whole idea there. To be a free black person in the South in the United States is a very difficult position to be in, and it's very different from other parts of the Americas where, if you think about Saint-Domingue and much earlier, in an earlier period in the 1770s and 1780s, where free black people become very large landowners, they become large slaveholders, and they become a very volatile class. And actually, the revolution in Haiti has a lot to do with the inability to contain free black people. So free black people have this very complicated place in slave society, and they're the constant object of discipline by slaveholders.
Had there been revolts in this country prior to 1831?
Sure. The biggest revolt is a revolt in a place called Pointe Coupee in 1795. There's another rebellion in Louisiana in 1811, which is probably the largest rebellion, and it's the one we actually know the least about. It really is the rebellion in Louisiana in 1811 really looks like a kind of massive Caribbean rebellion, and it makes sense a little bit because this is a sugar industry. It's really kind of an extension of the plantation economy of the Caribbean, which is based on very large sugar plantations, places where slaves outnumber white people by 10, 20 to 1. And southern Louisiana looks like that. And so you get this huge rebellion in 1811, but we know very, very little about it. There are episodes like the Stono Rebellion in South Carolina in 1741, which is a group of slaves who are in Charleston, and they're basically trying to run away. They're trying to make their way to Spanish Florida, which is on the, of course, on the border of South Carolina, but of course it's controlled by Spain at this point in the 1740s, and Spanish Florida is actually Catholic. And so these are slaves probably from Congo, from a part of Central Africa, where people are Catholic, and so they want freedom. They want freedom from slavery, but they also want freedom from Protestants. And so they're actually on a tear from Charleston down to Florida, and they basically kill everybody they see until they're put down after about a week. What you also get is a lot of conspiracies in the United States. So actually the same year in 1741, there's a very interesting conspiracy in New York. There's also a conspiracy very close to the period of Turner's Rebellion, which is Denmark Vesey's conspiracy
in
also.
Charleston.
In Charleston. And that's 1822. And Vesey is a free black man. He's a very interesting figure. He actually was the slave of a ship captain. He wins a lottery, and with the lottery, he buys his freedom. And he remains in Charleston. He's a very active figure in churches there, and it looks like he began to organize this conspiracy. It's become recently a controversy because there are historians who argue that the conspiracy was concocted by the slaveholders. And one of the things you do get in the United States that's also unusual is that you get a lot of panics, these waves of panic that just sweep over communities of white people where they're absolutely convinced that there's a rebellion in the works, and they just go on these kind of mob hanging parties, and it happens every 10 or 20 years. And so some people argue that Vesey is that. I'm take the view with other historians that there was a plot afoot, but obviously there's a lot of work to be done to ferret out exactly what was going on.
But that was, figuratively speaking, the soil in which Nat Turner comes from in Virginia, born in 1800.
Right. You know, it's not that far from Charleston. It's clear that slaves know about other kinds of rebellions. People have traced the knowledge of the Haitian Revolution in various parts of North America, and the stories of that are actually brought by planters who migrate, and many of them migrate with their slaves. They settle into the United States. So slaves know about a tradition of slave rebellion. We don't know what Turner knew about that, but I'm sure he knew something about it. One of the things, though, I think that's striking to me about Turner is that I think he was hesitant about his rebellion. If you read his account of it, it looks like he was thinking about this for about 10 years before he finally did it.
He was an extraordinary person by any accounts, rebellion or not, at least from his own lengthy and articulate confession, which was, I guess, dictated. He said of his early life,
"Being at play with other children, when 3 or 4 years old, I was telling them something which my mother, overhearing, said it had happened before I was born. I stuck to my story, however, and related things which went, in her opinion, to confirm it. Others being called on were greatly astonished, knowing that these things had happened, and caused them to say in my hearing, I surely would be a prophet, as the Lord had shown me things that had happened before my birth."
Yeah, so there is this idea that Turner is a prophet, and for a long time it's just a question of when the inevitable inability of slavery to contain a prophet is going to happen. The way I read the confessions is that the idea that he's a prophet is something that is very much his neighbor's idea. And it's something that he kind of comes to accept rather slowly and reluctantly. And so there are certain kinds of episodes where, for example, at a very young age, it's clear that he knows his letters and he can spell certain words. And there's a moment where he begins to get this sense that there's something special about him. But I think, like a lot of kids who feel like they're special, they both think they are and they're not sure they are, and they're conflicted about that. And I think for Turner as a young man, he felt a certain kind of pressure to live up to those expectations. And in the confessions, you have a sense that sometimes he actually will withdraw from people when he feels those pressures especially hard. And the purpose of that is not to reject those suggestions, but in part it's to get some distance from it, I think, but also so that he won't do anything that will dash those expectations. He kind of withdraws. He says, I held myself aloof.
Yes.
And I think it's a way of getting some distance from those pressures, but also not doing anything that would shake people's belief that there's something special about him.
What was his – I realize he was a slave, of course, but what was his profession? What was his work?
He's a plowhand. For a long time, people actually thought that maybe he was an artisan because he seems to be getting around and he seems to know a lot of people. But I think that probably comes from a sort of unusual geography of ownership in that he has, I think, 3 owners. He's sold these different times, and yet he's sold in within a relatively small area. So he's sold within the county. And so the reason that he knows a lot of people is because he's lived in different parts of the county. But his job is simply he's a plowhand. And so part of what he does as he's working is he spends a lot of time by his own account sort of thinking about particular passages of scripture that affect him very powerfully and just kind of reflecting on the meaning of them in the same way that a preacher might begin with a piece of scripture and then just tease out meaning layer after layer of meaning. He's kind of doing that for himself, and he's doing that over the plow.
We'll find out how the rebellion came about in just a moment. You're listening to University of the Year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Since the commencement of 1830, I had been living with Mr. Joseph Travis, who was to me a kind master and placed the greatest confidence in me. In fact, I had no cause to complain of his treatment to me. On Saturday evening, the 20th of August, it was agreed between Henry, Hawk, and myself to prepare a dinner the next day for the men we expected, and then to concert a plan, as we had not yet determined on any. Hawk, on the following morning, brought a pig and Henry brandy, and being joined by Sam, Nelson, and Will, and Jack, they prepared in the woods a dinner, where about 3 o'clock I joined them. I saluted them on coming up and asked Will how came he there. He answered his life was worth no more than others, and his liberty as dear to him. I asked him if he thought to obtain it. He said he would or lose his life. This was enough to put him in full confidence. Jack, I knew, was only a tool in the hands of Hawk. It was quickly agreed that we should commence at home, Mr. J. Travis's, on that night, and until we had armed and equipped ourselves and gathered sufficient force, neither age nor sex was to be spared.
The words of a remarkable man, a slave by the name of Nat Turner, who instigated what became a very well-known revolt in Southern Virginia in 1831. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Tony Kaye. And our subject is Nat Turner and his revolt. It would be very easy to say from 170 years later, well, of course, it was the natural thing to revolt. He probably was whipped. He probably was suppressed in all kinds of ways and thwarted. What were the motives? What was the impetus for Nat Turner to rebel?
I think it probably has relatively little to do with the issue of treatment. What Turner says about his own relationships with slaveholders isn't about that. I have no doubt that Turner was whipped, or if he wasn't whipped, people he loved were whipped. If they weren't whipped, then they knew that they could be, and the fear of that kind of punishment is ever present. When he actually describes his relationships with slaveholders, it really reflects a certain kind of intimacy that I referred to before. When he talks, for example, about this idea that he's a kind of special child, the white people in his neighborhood are very much a part of that. So his grandparents are the first people to kind of notice that there's something special about him. But when he talks about the people who recognize that he was special, it also involves slaveholders and people who knew his owners. And so he's very engaged with other religious people in Southampton, including religious white people. So I don't think that the rebellion is really about treatment. I think it's something that he took up very reluctantly. If you read the confessions, he has these visions of being contacted by the spirit, which is what he calls God. And you can see that in a way he is taking this up as a certain kind of responsibility, as a burden really, which is what happens to everybody God talks to in the Bible, right? And I think he feels it that way. And so that's why it takes him so long to actually embark on this. But I think it's just something that he sees. He sees the wrong of it. Something has to be done. And the question is he the one to do it? Does he have the capacity? Does he have the powers to do it? Because there's nothing on the ground, there's nothing on the political terrain that tells him that he can destroy slavery. And so I think it's only this idea that he has this special relationship with God, that God wants him to do this, and that God will help him do this, that makes him believe that he can do this.
According to, again, to his confession, he had some peer support in that too. He says,
And the Negroes found fault and murmured against me, saying that if they had my sense, that they would not serve any master in the world. And about this time I had a vision. And I saw white spirits and black spirits engaged in battle. The sun was darkened, the thunder rolled in the heavens, and blood flowed in the streams. And I heard a voice saying, "Such is your luck. Such are you called to see. And let it come rough or smooth, you must surely bear it."
That's the call. It's the call from the Spirit. It's the call from God that you must do this, rough or smooth, and either way you have to bear it. It's not your privilege. It is your burden. It is your task. And you'll carry this the way Jesus carried his cross. So it's something that he is being called to do. And he has this revelation that you've just read is really, it's just, you know, the most brilliant thing you've ever read of a slave's thinking about God. And, you know, you have to think about that as a historian of, you know, what do you make of somebody who looks up in the sky and sees a premonition of a slave rebellion complete with peals of thunder and blood? So I think part of this has to do with that you just have to think about a certain kind of Christian piety that is very different from what we're used to and that is very common in this day and age. But we live in a time when there are lots of evangelical Christians. Some people think we're living in, I guess it's the fifth great awakening we're up to. But the fifth great awakening that, you know, we're living in is very different from the second great awakening of which Turner is the product, where people really do feel God's presence at certain moments in their life with a kind of intimacy and power that is really hard for us to grasp. So obviously, he's a guy who, you know, looked into the sky and saw these things that we would have to say were not there. And so we know what we think of people who see things that aren't there. We have all kinds of names and diagnoses for them.
Unless they're in the Bible. That's the catch.
You know? And I think that's the thing. He thinks of himself as among them, you know, that he is part of this kind of prophetic landscape. He's another chapter in the story of the Old Testament.
And he goes on, though, with this remarkable vision, which I can't think of anything quite like it in the Bible. He says,
"I looked and saw the forms of men in different attitudes, and there were lights in the sky to which the children of darkness gave other names than what they really were, for they were the lights of the Savior's hands, stretched forth from east to west, even as they were extended on the cross on Calvary for the redemption of sinners. And I wondered greatly at these miracles, and prayed to be informed of a certainty of to the meaning of thereof. And shortly afterwards, while laboring in the field, I discovered drops of blood on the corn, as though it were dew from heaven. And I communicated it to many, both white and black, in the neighborhood. And I then found on the leaves in the woods hieroglyphic characters and numbers with the forms of men in different attitudes, portrayed in blood, and representing the figures I had seen before in the heavens. And now the Holy Ghost had revealed itself to me and made plain the miracles it had shown me. For as the blood of Christ had been shed on this earth and had ascended to heaven for the salvation of sinners and now was returning to the earth again in the form of dew, and as the leaves on the trees bore the impressions of the figures I had seen in the heavens, it was plain to me that the Savior was about to lay down the yoke he had borne for the sins of men, and the great day of judgment was at hand."
Well, that certainly is biblical.
Yeah, he's putting himself as he is a part of the story of the revelation of God and man, that, you know, that God contacts people in certain ways. He did it through Noah. He does it through Christ. And now he's doing it through Turner. These kinds of visions, really, I have to say, this vision is, you know, uniquely poetic and it's uniquely intense, but it's not unusual in its order. So there are a lot of people who, and we don't have many narratives of this, but we have a few where people record their conversion experiences. And they often involve somebody who is in a very everyday place. I've read ones about people who are actually working at the plow. But I've read others of slaves, of a guy I'm thinking of in particular. I forget his name. But he's plowing. He hears a voice. First, he thinks it's his owner who's chewing him out about having screwed up his work. And then he realizes that it's actually Gabriel communicating to him. And suddenly, he's not in a cornfield anymore. He's in a place where his sins are rolling away and heaping up into mountains and then falling away, and just all of this stuff is happening. There's a certain part of this that I can't understand, and that maybe you can, and maybe most of our listeners can. But part of what's going on is the people who are intensely engaged with the Bible, who are using its extraordinary imagery and just working through that material in their own way with their own creative abilities, which in many cases are very formidable. I mean, that's, you know, the material that you've read is just, you can read that in many different ways, but a lot of it is just incredibly poetic about how sharp the image is and how much feeling and how many ideas those images contain and how crystalline they're distilled. And so what's interesting, though, about the moment that you're reading from where he's talking about the slaves murmured against me, that, again, is a reference to Exodus. What he's referring to is the moment in Exodus where Moses leads the Israelites out of Egypt. They get to the wilderness, and then suddenly everybody said, well, there's no food. There's nothing to drink. And they start gefetching, as my people will. But the phrase in Exodus is, they murmured against me. When he uses that phrase, he is likening himself to Moses. And his neighbors, he's likening them to ungrateful Israelites. He has that revelation at a moment not where his powers as a prophet are being embraced, but where they've actually come into question. Because this is the one moment where he actually talks about having been treated badly. He comes under an overseer. And then he runs away from the overseer, and he lays out for 30 days, and people assume that he's just run away and run away for good, because that's what Turner's own father had done.
But Christ did that too.
Right, for 40 days, right. And so Turner comes back, and when he comes back, he's actually quoting the Spirit. And the Spirit says, he who knows his master's will and doeth it not shall be chastened with many stripes. And so what it sounds like is he's run away. Everybody thought he'd lit out to freedom. Not only did he not light out to freedom, he comes back, and here he's spouting this kind of pro-slavery Christianity. Now, for Turner, he's talking about another master. And what he's really talking about is the Spirit and the Spirit telling him that he's got this other task. That's the master who will whip you if you do not obey. But his neighbors don't hear it that way. So my point is that this is a moment where actually he has sort of fallen out of favor among his neighbors. They're murmuring against him. And that's when he has this revelation. And suddenly it gets very explicit. There's blood in the sky and there's going to be blood.
And this sign that he's looking for, he interprets as being this eclipse.
Right. And so he has another message, and the message is, you know, next time you see an eclipse, then you'll know that that's the time to strike.
And by the signs in the heavens, that it would make known to me when I should commence the great work. And until the first sign appeared, I should conceal it from the knowledge of men. And on the appearance of the sign, the eclipse of the sun last February, I should arise and prepare myself and slay my enemies with their own weapons.
And it's interesting that slaves are very attuned to what is going on in the sky. So slaves have this very interesting way of keeping time, for example, where most people don't know dates. They'll kind of keep time by placing events in their own life in a kind of relationship to events that are widely known. Sort of time markers. So my child was born during cotton planting time or during the revival. And one of the most common time markers is what people call the year the stars fell, which is this huge meteor shower that's seen all over the South in, I want to say, 1822. And everywhere people remember that, you know, I came to this place 3 years after the stars fell or whatever. So people are very attuned to what's going on in the heavens, and they're learning all kinds of things there.
So the eclipse gives him this sign.
Right.
Now he's going to need
the moment.
Now he's going to need some followers.
Right. And so what he does is he goes back to the people in whom he has the most confidence. And it's striking that they number exactly four, because the truth is this is – not a period when a lot of people have a lot of confidence in Nat Turner. And so initially he calls together four people, and then they meet to really plan the thing, and a couple of people, other people are brought, and so he has six people at the outset of his rebellion. And they begin at the house of Turner's owner, which is the passage that you began.
Yeah, and it is mentioned in the beginning of the hour, this was a man for whom Turner had no personal enmity. I mean,
it's his owner, and I mean, it's a very striking moment where if you read the whole thing, his comrades actually insist. They go into the house, And he and Hark Travis climb in through a window. They go downstairs. They let everybody else in. And then somebody says, you have to kill the first person.
You're the leader, yes.
It's like, you know, kind of, now you tell me? But I think the idea is that they actually sense a certain kind of hesitancy in Turner, and they want him to prove that he can do this. Even the people that he has most confidence don't have entire confidence in him. They want proof that he's for real. And so they go into the owner's house, and he raises the axe over his owner's head, and he hits just a glancing blow. Now, that's a very odd moment, because if you are a person who lives on a farm, you use an axe. Slaves are constantly having to clear new ground. They cut trees every year. They slaughter pigs with axes. If you know how to use an axe, you know how to strike a death blow. And he doesn't miss because he doesn't have the skill. He misses because he doesn't quite have the heart. And so in the passage that you read, he's kind of trying to explain it away because it's very dark. But it's as dark for Will Francis, the guy who actually does kill his owner, as it is for Nat Turner. So the darkness doesn't explain it. What I think explains it is nobody hates slavery and slaveholders more than Nat Turner, and yet there are certain kinds of intimacies that make killing them a very fraught exercise.
And yet the deed is done, although...
Not by him.
Not by him. And they proceed on to other houses. And how does the revolt develop? Is it a snowball effect?
It is for a time. Basically, they start at about 2 a.m., and the home of Turner's owner is the first place they strike. And then they go from farm or plantation to farm, and they just kill as they go.
Because this is night and they're finding, I guess, most of these people are killed in bed.
Absolutely. And so they've gone through about half a dozen places and they get to a place called the Whitehead Farm and they take care of business there. And then Turner actually separates his forces and he tells them that he wants them to go in very quietly. Initially, he's telling them to go very quietly because they don't want to spread an alarm in the neighborhood. And at Whitehead's, he divides his forces and he tells one detachment that I'll catch up with you in that neighborhood. And what he's saying there is, in effect, that they're kind of crossing a boundary. And when they leave his neighborhood, they're actually leaving the terrain that he knows best and where the people know him best and where he feels like he's most confident that he can actually draw people to him. And so when they go into this new neighborhood, he actually changes tactics. Instead of going in a stealthy way to avoid waking up the white people, he actually tells them to rush onto the plantations, to ride up as fast as they can, make as much racket as they can, because he actually wants to kind of knock people back on their heels. He wants to, he says, spread terror wherever we go. And he wants to frighten people to back them up. And he doesn't make any distinctions between black people and white people in that. In other words, he's leaving his neighborhood. He's going onto a territory that is slightly alien terrain. And he needs new tactics because he's less sure of his ability to draw people to him.
Is he controlling these people or does it not matter?
I think it does matter. I think it matters to him. I mean, any kind of rebellion, especially at this moment where, you know, it's a military exercise and a military exercise requires a certain kind of discipline. And so if he's not controlling them, somebody else does need to be. And part of what happens is that he does attract more followers at the height of the rebellion. It looks like it's something, it's probably as many as 60 people. But as they proceed from farm to farm, they gather a few new recruits as they go along. They also start to draw people from different neighborhoods, and they begin to kind of pull in different directions. So Turner's idea is that he wants to go to the county seat. The county seat is actually called Jerusalem. And he has the idea that in Jerusalem there is a cache of weapons, which is not an unreasonable thing to believe about a county seat, but it actually turns out to be untrue. And it may be that the idea that there are weapons there is a little bit of wishful thinking on Turner's part. I think he kind of wants to march on Jerusalem because it's part of this sense that, you know, I really am part of the narrative of the Old Testament.
Does he actually kill somebody?
He kills one person, and it's a very interesting moment where they're on one farm. It's daybreak at this point, and they are having a hard time gaining control of the situation. So the white people are fleeing out of the house. He sees a woman who is a teenager, somebody he knows, And he realizes that she is about to flee the premises. And he realizes that if she gets out, she's going to spread the alarm. And he picks up a fence rail and whacks her across the head and knocks her dead. It's a moment where he's just thinking, either I do this right now or we're really in trouble. And so he does it. And so it's only under that situation of extremis that he actually can kill, at least by his own account.
How do the slaves on these farms, assuming there are some at least, react?
There are slaves everywhere he goes, and as I say, some of them do join him. But they don't join in massive numbers by any means. Basically, at the height of the thing, as I say, it looks like there are about 60 slaves who join in. They've gone through something like, by his account, about a dozen farms. They start out with six. So what you're talking about is, you know, maybe four or five people are joining him at each place. And so that's by no means the majority of the slaves in the area. And so when people, if you look at the trial transcripts and a little bit in the account and the confessions, you get a sense that some people are going towards the rebels. Some people are fleeing from the rebels.
Any of them actually helping the whites?
There are people who actually hide white people. And there are also slaveholders who claim that they have every confidence that their slaves are going to help them. So they're giving orders, and they're giving orders to their slaves, and they expect them to do it. And so I think Turner is not entirely surprised by this. That's why he gives these orders for this different kind of approach. So slaves have many reactions. One is to join. One is to flee. And one of the things that's really striking is that Turner seems to take a somewhat circuitous path early on. And one historian has suggested that he's doing that because he wants to avoid the farm where his wife lives. And the reason is, I think, because he knows that all hell is going to break loose wherever they go and people are going to get killed. And it could very well that some slaves are going to get killed. So he doesn't want to bring that on his wife. He also may not want to implicate her in the revolt. But I think also he just doesn't want to bring this kind of terror to her door.
We're going to find out what happens to Nat Turner and his revolt when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Tony Kaye, and we're talking about Nat Turner's revolt in August of 1831 in southern Virginia. And Nat Turner and his group, up to maybe about 60 fellow slaves now, have been attacking farms in that part of Virginia, his neighborhood, we'll call it, and have killed dozens of people, mostly in their beds. But sooner or later, word is going to get out and the whites are going to respond in a large coordinated measure.
Yeah, so as they proceed from farm to farm, they're picking up a few followers, but not a majority of the slaves that they cross paths with by any means. And so what his forces at this point sort of collect several different groups, slaves from different neighborhoods, and so they have the, sort of their own solidarities. And some of these are people who they know other people who are in Turner's ranks, but they don't necessarily know Turner. And the thing does begin to escape from his grasp. So what he wants to do is to march on Jerusalem.
The symbolism.
Exactly. And he's very determined that's his objective. But as he proceeds along, there's a group of slaves who want to recruit in a particular farm that they pass. It's the Parker Farm, and it's just a few miles outside of town. And at that point, a debate kind of breaks out where Turner says, I want to proceed to Jerusalem. We're not going to stop here. And a group of slaves say, no, we are going to stop here. We have friends or family here, and we want to recruit. And there's a debate, and basically Turner loses the debate. And so most of his group actually just decide that they're going to go into the quarters and recruit there. But Turner doesn't go. And the reason that he doesn't go is that basically he's a stranger here. He can't help them recruit there. And so he stays at the gates of this farm. farm with this small group of people, and he's just cooling his heels, waiting for them to come out of the quarters with whoever will join them. And it's just at this moment where they actually are attacked for the first time. So what's actually been happening since daylight is that white people are beginning to rally, and this is the place where they finally catch up with Turner.
This is in the form of a militia then?
It's a militia, and it's people who are sort of joining. And this is sort of where my work on the rebellion is going now, where I've found the muster of the people who are in the militia that shows up the first day. And it's a huge force. It's 800 people. So this is 800 people who are rallying against a group of just 60 slaves. I've looked at the militia lists of people who rally from this area against the British in the War of 1812, and it looks like it's not much bigger than the force that rallies against Turner. So it gives you a sense of how Turner really did knock these people back out on their heels, that they feel like they have to muster a force that is as large as the force that rallied against the British in 1812. But they really do converge on the rebellion, and it's at this moment where they're attacked at Parker's Gate. Turner actually does get out of there, but his force is beginning to disband. When they get out of that fighting, I think there are about 20 slaves left. He decides to get to Jerusalem from another direction. He goes south to try to cross from a bridge. He finds his way blocked. And he decides he's actually going to go back to his neighborhood. Basically, he's going to go back to where they started, and then they'll rally a new force, and they'll try to march on Jerusalem again. And he begins this very circuitous path back to his neighborhood. And it's circuitous because they're kind of being converged on from all directions, and he doesn't even have a clear path. There's no clear path to Jerusalem, and there's no clear path back to his neighborhood.
And this is only, what, maybe 36, 48 hours after this whole thing has begun?
It begins at 2 a.m. and they begin to attack the next day. And so it's over within, 36 hours. By the time it's over, he's down to two people. And he tells the last two guys, go find the guys I started out at the beginning. Tell them to meet me back at Cabin Pond, which is where they started. And he goes back to Cabin Pond and nobody shows. And so he is at large for fully 10 weeks, and rumors have him all over the place. A lot of people are sure he's made his way to the Dismal Swamp. The Great Dismal Swamp is this huge swampy area in northern North Carolina. It's a very obvious place for him to go. It's only 20 miles away. But there are also people who are claiming to see Turner as far away as, as 180 miles to the west, marching to Ohio. And the fact that the whole time he's just laying out in his neighborhood.
He is actually literally, by his own account, he has taken this rather small sword, which I guess is his only weapon, and dug a little hole under some fence rails, and he's, I guess, foraging by night.
Right. And so by his account, it's a very kind of solitary existence for those 10 weeks. And I think the spirit of the account may actually be correct, that he doesn't want to show himself even to people in his neighborhood because he's not sure who he can trust. By his account, there's a dog that kind of sniffs him out because he has some meat in this little hovel that he's grown. And the dog actually is accompanied by two slaves, and they actually run away from him by his account. And so by his account, those 10 weeks are very solitary. I think that probably isn't the case. I don't see how he could have laid out for 10 weeks in his neighborhood without help. And so he probably does have some help, but he's also trying to obviously protect people from the retribution, because the retribution is vast. It stretches over a very broad area. Actually, Harriet Jacobs, the author of a very famous slave narrative, talks about after Turner's rebellion across the border in North Carolina, white people are going on a rampage. What's going on in Southampton is that they're basically rounding up black men everywhere, and some people are killing them indiscriminately. Some people are bringing them in for questioning. And there's an interim there where it's just mob violence, and it's just open season on black people. So part of suppressing the rebellion is about white people reestablishing their authority. The first way they do that is with this kind of indiscriminate violence. But then they kind of make a show of a return to business as usual, which is to actually bring this thing into law. And so they actually prosecute slaves for involvement in the rebellion in court. They give them due process, and they want it to be due process because that shows that, in fact, we're back in control here.
And this is going on, I guess, even before they catch Nat Turner. There is a list in one of the sources that shows that, you know, they questioned this one and dismissed and convicted this one and so on. Although the net was wide, how many did they actually end up executing?
I actually forget the exact number. I want to say it's in the 20s. But there are a lot of people who are just shot dead where they stand in the first couple of days. And then there are a lot of people who are actually found guilty, but they're not executed. They're actually exiled. They're basically sent into the slave trade. And so that kind of spreads the suppression of the Turner Rebellion to other states, because everybody knows that Virginia is sending out rebels into the slave trade. I've seen records of slaveholders as far as Mississippi who think that they actually owned a slave who was one of Turner's comrades. So there are lots of people who are found innocent of participating in the rebellion. There's a lot of fear that the rebellion has spread, but there is a trial of a dozen slaves in a neighboring county in North Carolina, actually, where 12 slaves are accused. One person is exonerated, and they realize that there was so little evidence against that one person that they just actually dismissed the charges against the other 11. So it does become a legal proceeding, and it's not a fair legal proceeding, but these aren't show trials either.
And Nat Turner finally caught, I guess, by
10 weeks,
single farmer pointing a gun at him?
Yeah, that's the story. So it goes. So the story goes.
And the way he tells it, in fact.
Yeah. And so he's brought in and he talks about kind of – it feels like he's kind of being walked through this gauntlet of white people. He just feels like somebody could kill him at any moment. But he's brought in for trial. And during the period while he's waiting for his trial, he's actually interviewed by a man named Thomas Gray. And Thomas Gray is a lawyer who is actually – defending slaves in these proceedings. He has five clients. They are all duly convicted. And so I think the way to think about Gray is somebody who is part of the legal defense team is not somebody who's a defender of slave rebellion, but actually somebody who's part of the process of crushing the rebellion. He's just part of the legal part of it, the part where we show that we're back in charge here. And so all of his clients actually are duly convicted. But he also, having represented those people, he is conducting an investigation during those 10 weeks while Turner's at large. And by the time they meet, he actually knows a great deal about the rebellion. And so Turner's so-called confession is given to Gray.
The wording is such that it sounds maybe more like Gray than Turner probably would have actually spoken, but it's quite detailed in the description, literally, blow by blow, of the killings and the progress and deterioration of that revolt.
I think that the Confessions is a document. It's about 20 pages. You've been reading from it for this last hour, and so you get a sense of how vivid it is. And I think it's probably a combination. Part of it is what Turner actually said. Part of it is things that Gray actually picked up during this investigation while Turner's at large. And that investigation is conducted to a large degree by talking to other slaves. And so the confession, I think, what is not Turner's words, a lot of it is Gray's words, but a lot of that is what slaves had been telling him. So there are certain parts of the confessions where it's very obvious that the speaker is Gray and not Turner. But I think that if it's a composite account, it's a composite not just of Turner and Gray, but Turner, Gray, and what the slaves who talked to Gray told him.
One of the things that Gray was interested in, and a lot of other whites as well, was the extent of what might have been a conspiracy. And he says,
I here proceeded to make some inquiries of him, after assuring him of the certain death that awaited him, and that concealment would only bring destruction on the innocent as well as guilty of his own color, if he knew of any extensive or concerted plan. His answer was, I do not. When I questioned him as to the insurrection in North Carolina happening about the same time, he denied any knowledge of it. And when I looked him in the face as though I would search his inmost thoughts, he replied, I see, sir, you doubt my word. But can you not think the same ideas and strange appearances about this time in the heavens might prompt others, as well as myself, to this undertaking?
So he's saying others might have been moved by the same eclipse or the same signs that he was looking for and found.
But also moved by the same experience of slavery. And so there is an attempt by people who are trying to put down the rebellion to contain it. And containing it involves many things. It involves killing. It involves legal trials. But it also involves trying to figure out what the extent of the rebellion is, and that means the numbers of people involved, but also kind of figuring out what was its geography. And so there are a lot of historians who think that the Confessions of Nat Turner is quite misleading because it makes it look like it's really Turner's revolt, which is what we tend to call it, and that maybe it was really the revolt of slaves more broadly in Southampton, but also that maybe it was a plot that extended over a much larger area. And so that's a debate that goes on, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
What was the overall effect of Nat Turner's revolt?
I think it has, you know, very broad ramifications. So there is, for example, a debate in the state legislature of Virginia about whether actually to abolish slavery in the state. And it is the last of those debates. There's never another debate in a state that has slavery to abolish it. But it is a really striking thing that people in Virginia, which is, you know, until very recently, Virginia had really been not just, it's the place of the founders, but it's also the place where the first several presidents, and so it has this particular stature in the Union as it does somewhat in our memory of it. And so the fact that there's that rebellion gives you a sense of how dramatic its effect was. Its concrete effects are actually it results in a crackdown in particular on free white people. So there's a raft of new legislation in many states that constrains the already constrained freedoms of free black people. There are new attempts to regulate the slave trade. And the attempts to regulate the slave trade are interesting in the sense that in order to sell slaves in certain states, you have to provide what's called a certificate of good character. And specifically, what they're really thinking about is, I don't want any Southampton County slaves in my place. And so that kind of legislation gets passed. And that's kind of typical. My sense of, in a lot of places, rebellion leads to, in Haiti, it leads to the end of slavery. It ends to the first black republic in the Americas. In other parts of the Americas, slave rebellion leads to emancipation in a more complicated way. So British emancipation, which happens in 1834, it is very much hurried up by a succession, a wave of rebellions in Barbados in 1816, in Demerara in 1822, and then this huge Baptist rebellion in Jamaica in 1831. So there it also hastens emancipation. In the United States, the big effect that slave rebellions has, it seems to me, is actually on slave training. So after the Stono Rebellion that I mentioned earlier in the hour, there's a period where they basically stop importing slaves for a decade into South Carolina. And so when the slaveholders respond to Turner's Rebellion by trying to regulate the slave trade in somewhat new ways, it don't really slow its volume much, but it is typical of the kind of effect of slave rebellions in the United States, which often are shown most forcefully in the slave trade.
Did it pretty much end discussion of abolition of slavery in the South? I gather there had been anti-slavery societies in the South up until this point.
Well, there's a lot of anti-slavery in the South during the era of the Revolution. And that's really constrained well before this, although there is starting to turn up some new evidence about anti-slavery people in the South petitioning and being more organized than people had previously thought. But what is also happening is that 1831 is not only the year of Nat Turner's Rebellion, it's also the year of William Lloyd Garrison's publishing The Liberator. And so this is an important moment in the beginning of abolitionism in the North. And one of the things that Garrison has to deal with at the very outset is this event has happened. And people are looking to Garrison's response to Turner as a way of gauging, well, what is this new movement about? And actually what Garrison says is that this is inevitable, that as long as you have slavery, the South is going to have to live with these kinds of episodes. And yet he doesn't actually endorse what Turner does. So it actually, you know, happens at the same time as the beginning of what we're most familiar with as the abolitionist movement.
Our guest this hour has been Tony Kaye. He's a professor of history and religious studies at the Pennsylvania State University. Thanks for joining me this hour.
Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it a lot.
Our thanks to James Grant for providing a voice for Nat Turner for this hour, and to Jeff Godsey for providing the voice of Thomas Gray. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join Emily Auerbach and me for the next hour of University of the Air.